All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here. And I want to look at these verses because they are important to what we're studying in terms of rejection of authority. In point 21, we're almost wrapped up with this summary, in fact, here. There are various types of judgments that God can render to people, that he can put down on them. Various types of natural catastrophes, and that God can use. Leviticus 26:19 talks about this. I will also break down the pride of your power. I will make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. That is a metaphorical way of telling of intense drought, crop failures, no rain. Nothing penetrates iron, and nothing's going to grow through bronze. Your strength will be spent uselessly. You can cultivate all you want, fertilize all you want. For your land will not yield its produce, and the trees of the land will not yield their fruit. And so God controls the weather. And this is another thing people don't like to admit, but it's true. As a part of his authority, he controls the natural elements. That doesn't mean that he can't allow other people, say Satan, to control them at times. So it's going far too far to say God always controls the environment, because he doesn't. He chooses sometimes, we certainly can cite from Job, examples of where he let Satan do it. And if he let him there, and it's recorded, it's likely that it's happened other times. And all of that. He gives Satan a leeway to do certain things. For instance, it appears, I can't say for certain, but it appears there in the book of Revelation that Satan is the one given the key to the bottomless pit. And he goes down and lets out the demons that have been incarcerated in Tartarus. And I can't do that all the time, but he certainly is given that freedom, it looks, at least once. And of course, that's all he needs to unlock it once, let him out. So you've got various types of mental and physical problems. Verse 16. I will appoint over you a sudden terror. This is what people talk about, panic attacks. What do you think sudden terror is? So just read here and just fix your Bible up. I will appoint over you panic attacks. So when people say, well, I'm panicking. Why? Why are you panicking? Is God still on the throne? Has he fell off the throne somehow? Is he no longer in charge? I mean, is the universe coming down around our ears? Are you like Chicken Little? The sky is falling? The sky is falling? I mean, why are you panicking? I mean, is God still in control or isn't he? But it looks like he's not. I understand that. I've been there. Been there, done that. But he's still in charge, is he not? Our panic doesn't make God look any better. It makes us look like idiots. But God said, I will actually send this stuff on you. If you will not humble yourself and obey me. If you are not submissive, I have ways of dealing with you. And so he knows where people live, what they're afraid of, what your deepest, darkest fear is that you think, oh, nobody knows this. But God does. And as Job said, Job talked about this. He said, what I fear has come upon me. So Job had certain fears and all of that. I'm sure they were related to the loss of his family, things that we'd all normally fear. The death of your close relatives, loss of your children, all of this. And he lost all of this in a matter of days. A lot of his money and details of life. Job doesn't strike me as a guy that was that worried about those. My suspicion was it was the people, but he seemed to be more concerned with other people. So I will give you consumption and fever that will waste away the eyes and cause the soul to pine away. Also, you will sow your seed uselessly, for your enemies will eat that. And here's what we've got. We've got a Prozac nation, to coin a phrase. There's a movie called that, by the way, Prozac Nation. And we've got people on all kinds of, as Bob Dylan put it, dealing drugs that'll never cure your ills. When you're going to wake up. And the fact is, medical science can't fix demon possession. Medical science can't fix demon oppression. Medical science can't fix people who are at odds with God, whom God is just constantly twitting. And you say, well, that's mean. Why would God do that? Because he can. And he chooses to. And it's in his best interest to do so in some cases. Now, some people, this will bring them around. Now, I have to admit, it took Nebuchadnezzar a while. But let's face it, God smacked him around and he came around. Did he not? He writes this big tract there in Daniel chapter 4. It's brilliant if you read it. It's a tract that he sent out to the entire kingdom. The entire world of his day got evangelized because of Nebuchadnezzar. And he was one of the most arrogant men that ever lived. And God said, I can take you down. And he did. Now he smacked Pharaoh around just as much. And did Pharaoh respond? No. Nope. So he ended up dying and, you know, that's it. He's finished. So God has ways to get to people. He knows where you live. So this idea of I don't have to obey authority and God won't get me. Reject authority and see what happens. Take your chances. I wouldn't advise it because the Bible's very plain on this. Using predatory animals to make people miserable. Of course, now it's even worse because now we've got to be concerned about the plight of the bumblebee. If you got that, that's a little subtle humor there. Plight of the bumblebee. And the plight of the poor alligator. Endangered species. Really? These are brutal, cold-blooded killers. I don't care if they kill every alligator on the planet. Frankly, there'd be more bass. The fish life would multiply. But, you know, God can use animals to make things very miserable on you. I will let loose among you the beasts of the field, which will bereave you of your children. And destroy your cattle and reduce your number so that your roads lie deserted. And so God has control over the animal kingdom too. And he can have these predatory animals act in ways that you might not necessarily think are normal, but God controls it. Military reversals and defeats. Leviticus 26:25. I will also bring upon you a sword which will execute vengeance for the covenant. When you are gathered into your cities, I will send pestilence among you so that you will be delivered into enemy hands. And the fact is, when was the last war we won as Americans? World War II was the last one. We haven't been in a war since then, for one thing. You know, contrary to the propaganda you get shoved down your throat every day, there are no wars, not for our country at any rate. Now, there are wars for other people, but they don't have a constitution that mandates that Congress has to declare war. That the president can't unilaterally do this stuff. But we've systematically demolished the Constitution, pretty much. We've dismantled it to the point where it doesn't matter what they do. People just accept it and go along. And all these people out marching Saturday. Did it change anything? I wonder if Trump got up today and ate breakfast. Bet he did. Bet nothing's changed yet. So they're going to change the world by marching in the street. That's exactly what my Bible tells me to do. I see there are a lot of verses in here on that. Get out and march. Protest. This will change things. No. Generally, the Bible is submit to the powers that be. Even if you don't like them. Even if they're unrighteous. As long as there aren't moral or biblical issues, greater issues involved. This is pretty straightforward. Famine, obviously, if you're having trouble, though, with your, drought and all of that, famine's going to follow right on the deal. And particularly with military setbacks, this is very common in war-torn countries. And I will break the staff of your bread, verse 26. 10 women will bake your bread in one oven, and they will bring back your bread in rationed amounts so that you will eat and not be satisfied. And verse 9, further, if things get really bad, you will eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters. Under intense times of siege and all of this, this happened in cities, in ancient cities. They would eventually start cannibalizing one another. They didn't have any choice. Can you spell Donner Party? Mm-hmm. Then you'll know what that's all about. You get hungry enough. Well, sorry, son. It's been nice knowing you, but your dinner. Then you say, well, that's kind of cold and cruel. Yeah, but this is the God who inflicts this on these people. So ask yourself this question. Do they deserve it? And my answer is they must. If God's doing all this, unless you're going to impute unrighteousness to God, which I'm not going to go that route, then they must deserve all this. This must be what's called for by the necessity of the nature of things. And so even using satanic and demonic forces to administer judgment. This was actually in a parabolic context in Matthew. But the parable ends. Many interpreters have missed this. But the parable ends, and then Jesus just makes a couple of explanatory statements at the end of it. One specifically that's very important. Matthew 18. And this was about the slave who owed his boss, owed his lord, owed his owner $50 million. And he couldn't pay him. And so the owner forgave it all and let him go. And this slave goes out and grabs another slave by the throat that owes him 50 bucks. Says, "I want my 50 bucks." And so chokes him and demands repayment. When he can't repay him, he has him thrown in prison. Well, when the other slaves see all this going on, they're upset by it. They say, "Well, it's very inappropriate. You know, the owner forgave him $50 million. Now he won't forgive this guy 50 bucks. What kind of guy is this?" And so that's what they look at. And so the owner finds out what happened. They report back in verse 31, their lord. They tell their master, their owner, all that had happened. That's what lord means in this context, their owner. Now, they're slaves. And then summoning him, his lord said to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave? And in the same way I had mercy on you." And so the gist of the parable is, the primary teaching of the parable is, if God forgives us a debt we could never repay in terms of sin, he saves us out of spiritual death, which we could never do for ourselves. And then someone sins against us, can we not forgive them? Should we not forgive them? Is their sin against us greater than our sins against God? In terms of relative righteousness and all that. I mean, God's absolutely righteous, and we sin against him all the time. And he always forgives us through Christ. So, but we tell other believers, "I'm not forgiving that. This is unpardonable. I will never forgive you for what you did." If you've ever thought that, you better check yourself, because you're about to wreck yourself. Because God will not tolerate that attitude. His Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he should repay all that was owed him. And here's Jesus' commentary on this parable. "My heavenly Father will also do the same to you if each of you does not forgive his brother from his heart." Do what same thing? Turn us over to torturers. Now, who could torture people, I wonder? Who could he use for this that's very malignant, hateful, and hates the human race? I would suggest demons are the way he does it. Most primarily. That's not to say he couldn't use other means. But there are people who are tormented by demons. And we think we're going to fix them again with Prozac or Xanax. You're not going to fix them with that. You may sedate them. You may lithium down. But you aren't going to fix them. Because the problem is spiritual. So again, when you run across these problems in the human race, some people are just miserable people. They have miserable health. See, I would really be worried if I was sick all the time. Because it's not that sickness is necessarily a sign of sin in every case. But I've got too many promises in the Bible saying God promises health and a certain amount of prosperity if you'll fulfill his plan and pursue it. And when somebody's just sick all the time, maybe it's because of their negative volition. Have we considered that yet? That maybe that's the problem. Maybe they have stomach problems. And this has been proven. I mean, there's a significant medical research out there that will document that some people have digestive and other problems because they will not forgive. That they have these knots in their stomach and they hold grudges. And if you're a grudge holder, you better take these verses to heart. Because God doesn't... Does God hold grudges against you? And you've certainly sinned against him. No, he forgives and he forgets. Say, "Well, I'll forgive him, but I'll never forget it." You haven't forgiven him then. Because you have to forgive and forget as well. So God will torture people. You say, "Well, that sounds mean." Well, it is, but they deserve it. You know, they deserve to be tortured. And if they won't forgive, then mentally God's going to pound on them. And maybe physically pound on them. So again, some health problems are related to these issues of forgiveness and faith and other factors that people won't exercise. So additionally here, and you can also see 1 Timothy 1:20. I think that's where Paul actually intervenes in that one, if I remember right. Yeah, who I have handed over to Satan. And people can debate all day. You know, we can debate. Does this apostolic authority, can pastors do this today? Does this authority still exist? I don't know. I've never really had to throw anybody over to Satan. I've jettisoned a whole bunch of believers, I can tell you that. I mean, they were weighing down the ship, and I tossed them overboard. Sorry. You know, they were like Jonas. They needed to go. So toss them. And sometimes you just have to be brutal like that. And I know that sounds heartless and cold, but you don't do it apart from emotion, unfortunately. You feel for these people. I do. I feel bad for people that have wrecked their lives, but that doesn't change anything. Me feeling bad doesn't fix them. You know. So I handed them over to Satan, he says. So they're going to learn some things. Satan's going to work them over. He's going to pound them. Jesus said that to Peter. Satan has demanded to sift you as wheat. Demanded permission. And what is not ever said in there, but is implied, and by the way, I gave it to him. So take the Lord, tell him how mean he is. Why did he let Satan torment Peter like that? Well, Peter needed it. He needed some of the arrogance kicked out of it. And that's one way God can do it, is divine discipline. This will humble you. This will get you to where you're not so quick to condemn. You know, and it's easy to be self-righteous. And the more doctrine you get, the more danger you have to fight that. But always remember, the doctrine you got by grace. And if a person doesn't have that doctrine, well, the best thing you can do is pray for them. And then leave it up to the Lord. Well, 22, additionally, God is certainly free to use authorities he has established to execute justice on his behalf, which is something Paul will address in the subsequent verses. We'll see this in verse 4. It is a minister of God and avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. So if you want to get involved in criminal activity, go right ahead. No, don't. Because God will lower the boom on you. And again, if you're a positive believer, it may go very hard on you. But if you're otherwise negative and lukewarm, well, you know, we'll see how it goes. But God's not that interested in those children, unfortunately. They make him sick. He wants to puke when he thinks of them. Well, 23, therefore, it does not seem wise to limit the judgment to either God or the government, since both are free to punish those that oppose authority. My sense of it is the primary emphasis is on God's punishment, though, because it's his decree they're resisting. He's decreed authority and you don't like it. Now, verse 3, for rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. For explanatory conjunction gar here introduces its explanation. Why should we be submissive to earthly rulers? Because first, really, they don't do you harm except in certain circumstances. Generally, they will leave you alone. Am I afraid of the policeman? No. Why? I'm not committing crimes. The only people that need to be afraid of the police are people that are guilty. Now, what will guilty people do when caught? Here's what I've observed by watching TV and seeing people in real life situations, and here's the way to do it. If you're a criminal, what is the first rule of law for you? Deny, deny, deny. Well, I saw you over there. I saw you throw a rock through that. That wasn't me. No, but I saw you with my eyes. That wasn't me. That was my evil twin. And I just happened to come around the corner when he was running off. So you thought it was me, but it's not me. Deny, deny, deny. We've caught you. We got your fingerprints on the deal. Those aren't my fingerprints. Deny, 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 deny. Never admit the truth. That's what criminals do. And if you think you're going to get caught, what's the best thing to do? Flee. Flee. Run and deny. You were running from me. No, I wasn't. I wasn't running. I was my evil twin. Again, try to convince the cops that they're idiots, because they like this. They like being treated like they're stupid. But this is what criminals do. They run. What are they afraid of? That's what the problem is. They're afraid. And they should be afraid. If you're engaged in criminal activity, you ought to be very afraid. Because the boot can drop at any time. And how people think they're going to get away with this. We had a guy we worked with out there when I was out there at the park working, doing bookkeeping and stuff. We had this particular bookkeeper who was doing our taxes and different stuff and all. And one day I look up on the news and there he is. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this can't be good. What's he doing on the news? Well, apparently he'd taken a bunch of these older people and, you know, got access to their deals. They'd given him guardianship or whatever, or right to the do stuff with their finances, and he just drained their accounts because he had a gambling problem. Well, you know, that's not good. Did he think he's going to get away with this forever? How about Madoff? Do you think he's going to get away with this forever? And the fact is, the long arm of the law is called that for a reason. It always catches them. Eventually, given enough time, it'll catch them. They got Capone eventually, and he was pretty shrewd, really, if you go investigating. But the criminal always tends to get caught. And even if he doesn't, is he ever really safe or free or free from fear? Probably not. Why would he be? He's got to be looking over his shoulder. Well, for rulers here. Rulers is archon, A-R. That's not working. Let's try the next one. A-R-C-H-O-N. This comes from RK, to be first, or to be primary. So it means one who exercises authority as a ruler, leader, a commander, a judge, governmental officials of any kind. Are not, negative U, plus the present indicative of Imi. They are not a fear, literally. Phobos. P-H-O-B-O-S. We get our word phobia from this. Generally, a phobia is considered to be an irrational fear. This is actually rational fear. You should be afraid of the government if you're going to disobey them. If you're going to break the laws, fear is what you should have. But if you're a law-abiding citizen, rulers are not a cause of fear. They are not a fear. So again, this is the reaction one has when confronted with some force or power that frightens him. Objectively, it can refer to what causes the reaction of fear. And rulers are not a cause of fear. For good behavior. Again, for deeds or works, ergon, this gets into our overt behavior. And then agathos, morally good. What is correct, what is right, what is proper. What most people would acknowledge, A-G-A-T-H-O-S. Morally right. A dative of reference here, again, they're not a fear with reference to this specific aspect. Good deeds. If you're out there feeding the hungry, if you're out there clothing the poor, if you're out there doing good things for people, helping little old ladies across streets, let's say you're a real Boy Scout, for lack of a better term. What was the Boy Scout motto? Anybody know? Do a good deed daily. That was it. You know? Now, the Cub Scouts, they weren't quite as good. They were like, do your best. You know? That's why we all became Boy Scouts. We didn't want to stay Cub Scouts. You know, one day we'll be full-grown men. You never know when. So do a good deed daily. Do the right thing. And the Boy Scout motto and the ideals of the Boy Scouts were very high and noble, frankly. Unfortunately, it's been rife with abuse, as we know, but the fact is, it doesn't hurt you to know how to tie a number of knots. You may need them someday. Doesn't hurt you to know how to do certain things in a survival situation. Doesn't hurt you to know how to pitch a tent necessarily. Rulers are not a cause of fear for a good behavior. And in this context, the idea is law-abiding behavior. Those things that are appropriate. The person who abides by the law doesn't fear. See, when do you get afraid when you see a policeman going down the street? When you're speeding, right? I mean, or do you instinctively, the second you see that police car, do you suddenly look down at that speedometer? How fast was I going? Or if you know you're speeding. I mean, we've all done it. Again. So when do you get afraid? You get afraid when you think you're going to get caught. And you get caught when you think you're guilty. And so guilt factors into all of this. Again, you have this emotion of guilt to go along with the wrong that people do. They have to deal with the guilt aspect of it. So they're not a cause of fear for good behavior, law-abiding behavior, but strong adversity of Allah, but for behavior which is evil. He doesn't repeat the word deeds here, but he just uses the adjective kakos, K-A-K-O-S. Again, that which is harmful, evil, criminal, that which is not what it should be, that which is, again, it can be anything from irritating to downright dangerous. But behavior that's not appropriate. And in this context, it has to do with criminal behavior. Do you want to have no fear of the same? Now or but's not actually translated here. You've got the mild adversity of a conjunction, duh. Are you willing, thelo, T-H-E-L-O, to wish, will, or want? It's interrogative here. It's a present indicative interrogative. It's a question. Do you want not to fear? Not here, again, you've got a complementary infinity. Thelo takes an infinitive to complete its mean. I want to blank, whatever it is you want to. And in this case, it takes a negative. Do you want to not fear? Do you want to not be afraid? To not fear is negative me plus the present infinitive of phobos. Or actually, phobeo, the verb, P-H-O-B-E-O. Do you want to not be afraid of the authority? Or fear the authority? They put the word of in here like it's a genitive. It's not. Do you not want to fear authority? It's an accusative. It's just a direct object. The authority is what you would fear. Keep on doing. Poieo, P-O-I-E-O, means to do something. Keep on doing what is right. The good thing, literally. To agathos, again, the morally right thing. What's appropriate to the situation. What it calls for in terms of love. Do the right thing, essentially. Keep on doing the good thing. And you will have praise, and is chi, connective here. You will have future indicative of the verb echo. You will have epinos. Here is a noun, E-P-A-I-N-O-S. And epinos means recognition, that you will be recognized. It can also mean admiration or approval. Or even the overt aspects of all of that, praise. And they've gone with the overt aspect. You will have recognition or approval from the same. And again, while it's not perfect, the fact is, from time to time, you see this. The federal government, the state government, county, even local governments will recognize individuals who really contributed to society. Who really, as far as they can see, are doing good things. And all that. So you will have praise from preposition ek with the ablative of autos, here used in the intensive sense of the same, i.e. the same authority. The same authority that punishes criminals praises good people. Now they may not do the praising aspect as much as they should, and it may not be even handed, but the fact is they do from time to time, and this was recognized in Paul's day and should be recognized today as well. Well, point one, Paul continues his explanation as to why believers are to be mentally submissive to the government under which they live. The clause introduced by the conjunction gar here, for or because, introduces the second reason why believers are to be in subjection. Two, not only do they exist, the rulers, by the decree of God, they are charged with the very important matter of maintaining order in secular society. Again, all those people that are anti-authority, if they really got what they wanted, think about it. There would be no authority anywhere. No traffic signals. No stop signs. No right or wrong. No right of way, in fact. I mean, whoever gets there first goes. Whoever's got the biggest truck wins. I mean, because that's the way it's going to be. So I'm going to get me the biggest, baddest four-wheeler I can get, you know, jack it up so I can just run over people. I mean, we'll just play crush the cars in the parking lot. And that'd be the way life would be. The strongest, the meanest, those would be the ones that would govern everything. They'd run roughshod over people. This is the human nature, though. If it's left to itself, it comes to very bad things. And so those people, again, they don't want authority, they think. Yeah, but don't you like things to be organized? If there was no authority anywhere and people just did what they want, you know, robbery is going to be commonplace because, again, face it, you might have money I need. You know, I might like your car better than mine. Now, rather than just steal it, I'll just go ahead and swap it one night. You can just have the other car. I'll give you my, you know, Chevrolet Corvair, 1966 Corvair or Pinto. You know, and I'll take your Lexus or your Acura or whatever you drive, you know, Lincoln, whatever you got, I don't care. It's better than my Pinto, I know that. So, and, you know, by the way, I got a Pinto where the fourth gear doesn't work. So, you know, it's not going to be a good trade for you. But, you know, if I'm bigger and stronger and smarter, that's the way it goes. What can you do? So, again, we need authority. We need structure to society. People can't function without this. His explanation, point three, moves from that of the proper mental attitude, which has been emphasized in the first two verses, to the matter of overt behavior. And four, Paul continues to alternate between the principle or institution of government and the specific men that occupy authoritative positions in the government. Now five, the noun translated as rulers is the Greek participle of the Greek verb archo, which literally means to be first, to begin or initiate an action, or to rule or exercise authority over someone. That's the way it's used here. Six, the change from the term exousia to archon is likely just a matter of style. But the latter term, once again, emphasizes the superiority of governing authorities to the common people they rule. We are the common people. And that's just the way it is. People say, I don't like that. I don't like being the hoi polloi, the masses. But yes, that's all we are. And most citizens, that's what everybody mostly is. There are very few, there are fewer people, of course, with the proliferation of government. My God, I don't know. But at one time, there were far less people in government than there were in the private sector. But now with the expansion of government beyond its bounds, proper scope and all that, who knows? So many people depend on government jobs that what happens if they go? So again, without some of these things, you wouldn't have schools, you wouldn't have any ability to get educated, you wouldn't have a lot of things. It'd be very difficult to get back and forth to work. I mean, if you haven't seen it, it wasn't a great movie or anything, but if you want to watch Anarchy, watch Mad Max. And then you'll see how easy it is to get to places, to get water, to get what you need in a society that's run by anarchy. So five, the noun again emphasizes here, or six rather, the superiority. It means they're first. They were translated as superior or hupereko, to be above. Well, archon emphasizes that again, that authoritatively they're above us, that we have to be under authority. Seven, while the Greek literally says that rulers are not a fear, the noun phobos may refer to the emotion of terror or dread one feels. Or it may be used in the concrete sense of that which causes the fear or terror. And that's the way it's used here. So you see in the New American Standard, they've translated it, and rightly so here, they are not a cause of fear. They don't strike fear into people, generally speaking. If you're doing the right thing, you're not afraid. Nobody fears the right, or you shouldn't. Eight, Paul states that those who rule over others in secular government are not a cause of fear for one segment of society, but are a cause of fear for another. And nine, he states that rulers do not cause fear to the good work, which most have taken to be a collective singular that deals with the entire lifestyle of the righteous, law-abiding citizen. And 10, the adjective agathos, good, refers to that which is philosophically or morally good. That which is good in the sense that it is something of which God approves. And we might say again, because Paul mentioned this at the end of chapter 12, to do what's right in the sight or in the opinion of all men emphasizes those certain lifestyles that everybody approves of in general. That doesn't mean everybody without exception. But in general, people approve of law-abiding citizens. Of friendly people who are helpful, who are there not to take advantage of you. That's the, you know, most people think, okay, I like that kind of person. They're easier to like, for one thing. Well, 11, Paul informs Timothy that the Mosaic law is not something that is necessary for the person that engages in righteous behavior. And in that context, he's talking about the Mosaic law, but in real life, any law works this way. Why do we have a system of laws? You say, well, why do we? Why do we have a system of laws? Because we're legislating morality. Now, how many times have you heard say the argument, you can't legislate morality? That's a bald-faced lie. That's what laws do. They legislate morality. It's immoral, according to baseball, to spit on the ball and then pitch it. It's wrong. That's part of their rules. You can't take some Brill cream off your hair and rub it on the baseball and slick it up. It's immoral. They don't see that as being a moral action. Now, is baseball a moral game? No. No, I don't think it really deals with principles of right and wrong. It's an athletic contest. So should you cheat an athletic contest? Well, no, probably not. And they all have their rules, Deflategate. And so you understand that the other team somehow wasn't playing with that same football. Oh, yes, they were. So if the football gave one team an advantage, why didn't it give the other team an advantage? Assuming all that happened. Now, I don't even care if it happened. They were both playing with the same football. It's not as though they, you know, were able to, you know, take out and get a new football every time. Well, here, the offense you use this, and we'll give this to the other team. We'll give them the football that isn't even shaped like a football. We'll make it harder on them. No, you can't. They're all playing with the same ball. So again, if you engage in righteous behavior, you don't need rules. I don't need a rule to tell me I can't clothesline the guy when I'm playing basketball, or cross body blocking, or hack him in the arm when he's shooting. I kind of know that this is not fair. There's a moral issue to it at some level, I suppose, in that I know it's not right. And so everything's governed by laws and rules, and they legislate morality for that, whatever it is. And we have laws and rules in society. Realizing the fact, as he says here, that law, any law, is not made for a righteous person. I.e., law-abiding people don't need rules. Because they're going to do what's right. They love their neighbor as themselves. And that's what it really means to fulfill the law. Of course, Paul's going to say that coming up here in chapter 15, I believe. Love is the fulfillment of the law. If you want, you don't have to worry about memorizing what to do and what not to do. Walk in fellowship and exercise love towards people and you will do the right thing. That's the structure, the gist of the New Testament. Well, 12, while that is true of the Mosaic law, it is also true of legal codes in general. Laws are not designed for the righteous person. The person that knows and does what is morally right, he doesn't need a law to tell him what that is. He knows what it is instinctively. 13, that type of person does not engage in behaviors that wrong, endanger, or harm others. Rather, he lives in a way that keeps the good of others in mind. This is what we're exhorted to do. Not just to think about ourselves. When are you the most miserable and unhappy? I can tell you without equivocation that it is when you are focused on you. This something isn't going right in your life. Somebody did something to you. Whatever it is, it's all about you, me, I. And that's when you're the most miserable and unhappy in your life. Because your focus is on the wrong thing. You're not concerned with the Lord and how it impacted him or other people. It's just all about you. And that leads to a miserable lifestyle. Do nothing, as he says here in verse 3, from selfishness or empty conceit. But with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Well, the righteous person does this. This is what righteousness is. So 14, in that context, good behavior results in one being obedient to the laws that exist, with an emphasis on the right of the government to legislate a moral and civil code that promotes a safe and peaceful society. And 15, while many people have adopted the view that one can't legislate morality, the truth is exactly the opposite. Most laws and regulations that are proposed, passed, and enforced have inherent within them some idea of the good that they seek to promote or preserve. And 16, it is an oversimplification, though, to say that all laws have a moral basis. For instance, rules that govern parking places, time limits, and speed limits are somewhat subjective. And they're not really based on moral right or wrong. How do I know this? I talked to a guy whose specialty was traffic. He told us one night, I didn't talk to him, but I mean, I saw him at a meeting and listened to him talk. And he told me that, typically speaking, the way speed limits are determined is based on the number of lanes present and other factors, how much of a shoulder. There are various things that go into this. And instinctively, that a person has a sense of what a safe speed is. Normal people. I got to qualify everything today with normal people. Have a sense. I mean, he acknowledged this as a traffic engineer. The normal people have a sense of what a safe speed is. When you go down, say, if you go down Honoree south off of Fruitville, that, of course, Honoree all the way down, it's a series of roundabouts. I mean, do you really, if you go down that way, if you've ever gone down that way, or any place where they have roundabouts, do you really feel that 60 is a safe speed for a roundabout? Or do you have this inherent thinking in your mind that you should slow down as you approach this? But, and a normal person knows what this is. Now, he also intentionally said sometimes they intentionally set speed limits low because they can get more tickets that way. So the instinctive idea of the normal person is 50 is a safe limit on Fruitville. Well, we're going to set it at 45. Why? Because even though 50 is safe, we can write more tickets this way. So that's not necessarily moral, is all I'm getting at here. Or how long, if a parking space is 15 minutes or 20 minutes, is there a moral issue there? Not that I can see, you know. Now, is it morally wrong to have 500 handicapped parking spaces that nobody parks in while everybody else parks a half a mile from the store? Now, see, I think that's morally wrong. I think that's dumb. But that's the nature of the society we live in. But there's nothing immoral about what they're doing. Theoretically, it's for good of all the handicapped people. But I say have these spaces set empty more than half the time. So maybe this isn't well thought out. Now, that's one of the issues you have with government. Do they always think through what they're doing and come to the best decision? Yes. No. They don't. I'm being facetious. They don't. But we can't allow that to influence us. So, again, certain things aren't always moral, but laws regarding property, rights, all of this, those are all moral laws. Laws that affect other people. So, 17, however, while they may not be moral matters, it is evident that there is some larger good is served, or attempting to be served by such ordinances. I presume when they have a parking limit on a place, it's because that place is in high demand. There are a lot of people that want to be there. And so we want to set a time limit that makes it as convenient for everyone, not just for me, although it should be me that they should be worrying about. They don't. They want to worry about everybody and give everybody a fair chance. Okay, see, there's still a moral good there being served. Even though it's not a, quote, moral issue, there's still a good being served to society in general by these things. Well, 18, what Paul indicates here is that government has the power to enforce moral and legal standards upon people. Particularly standards that seek to restrain behaviors that are harmful to other individuals or society. And the logic of morality indicates that no one has the inherent right to do wrong to someone else. That's not a right you have. I don't have that right. Nobody has that right. My rights end where other people's rights begin. That's a fact. Your rights to play your music as loud as you want is fine until I have to hear it. Then I have the right to say, turn it down. I don't want to hear it. And by the way, what you're listening to isn't music. But, you know, that's what I do when I'm out. I don't really do it. But I would like to sometimes. Turn that down. It's not music to start with. It's raucous. It's horrible. So the law serves as a limitation on the individual freedom of one person to act in ways that do wrong or bring harm to others. Inherent, and see, this is why do people not like the law or government or authority? Because it is there to thwart the sin nature. And the sin nature doesn't want to be thwarted. It is incapable of submitting itself to the law of God, nor does it even want to. As Paul so eloquently stated back in Romans earlier. So be inherent within the concepts of right and wrong is the corresponding truth that governmental authorities are established to punish those that do wrong to others. The threat of punishment serves as a deterrent to certain behaviors among, again, I should have emphasized this and bolded, normal people. Normal people, if I tell you, don't go outside and push Linda down because she's on her stroller. Or whatever, not stroller, but whatever it is. Stroller. I may put her in a stroller and bring her. There comes Linda in a baby carriage. Well, she got love and marriage first, so that's good. Anyway, I tell you not to do that. And you do it. Well, you have made yourself liable to punishment. You have made yourself liable. See, I didn't make you liable. I just told you what the rules were. And if you do it, there's going to be consequences. And this is why we discipline our children. We teach them there are consequences to actions. Because if they don't know this, when they get out there in the world, they're going to find out the very hard way that there are consequences to actions. So inherent within this is the right to punish those who do wrong to others. Again, the threat of punishment serves as a deterrent among normal people. If I tell you, if you do that, I'm going to shoot you in the leg. Well, you're less likely to do it if you don't want to get shot in the leg. Now, if you don't care about getting shot in the leg, first, there's something very wrong with you. You should. But see, that's what normal people are. Normal people don't want to be shot or stabbed or burned or choked or any of these things. So, see, laws are enforced by the threat of punishments that may range from monetary fines to the loss of rights or privileges. And in extreme cases, it can involve the forfeiture of property or life. And so the government has various ways they can encourage you to obey. And that is the way, the punishment aspect of it. If you commit certain crimes are attended, most misdemeanors are attended only by fines. And that sort of thing. Now, they've demonized certain crimes and made them way worse than they actually are. We recognize that. That's a problem. There's this phony baloney morality that exists out there in the world that's not necessarily God's morality. We should know that. That the world has its deal of what's right and wrong and what's praiseworthy. Like I said, for 3 hours last night, the most important thing happening was Gasparilla for Kids. Really? I didn't see that as important at all, ever. And yet there was thousands and tens of thousands of dollars spent on a law enforcement presence there. And by the way, maybe that's the one you want to go to if you want to go to one of these. I've heard you don't want to go to the one next week. I've never been up there, but I can imagine about what it's like. It's like Mardi Gras in Tampa or wherever they have it at. And I've been down to Key West. Every night they got a street deal like Mardi Gras. Attended by weirdos and freaks, oh my. And guess what? They're not normal. There's an excess of drinking, partying, all this stuff's going on, drugs, no doubt. Demon activity all over the place. But that's what people like. Well, that's a phony, baloney bunch of morality there, because that's not at all healthy or safe or anything else, really. And if people would behave themselves, it would be, but guess what? They won't behave themselves. They'll be up there drinking to excess, throwing up in people's yards, deciding they need to use the bathroom in your truck, whatever else they do. God, they've done worse than that. Well, God knows. So, again, here, Paul goes on now to say that governmental authorities are a cause of fear for the evil thing. Again, most interpreters understand that this is a collective singular that deals with various types of evil that characterize the lifestyle of the criminal. And by the way, one of the things you have to ask yourself is how many crimes do you have to commit to be a criminal? If you break one law, you might as well have broken them all because you're a criminal. Now, that doesn't mean you should keep breaking it. Oh, well, I'm a criminal. What can I do? I mean, that mentality shouldn't fly. So, but a criminal has a particular lifestyle. Whereas you and I, we may break a law inadvertently. We may even break it on purpose occasionally. But that's not our lifestyle. That's not what we would do all the time. And hopefully when you break a law or you deal with it, you recognize, well, that was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. I really shouldn't have done that. And then you deal with it before the Lord. Well, 20, although Paul phrases his thoughts here in terms of overt actions, good and evil things, it should be evident that he is actually speaking of a person engaging in the good or the evil. And 21, the next clause here introduced by the conjunction does in verse 3 here may be understood as a conditional statement or a rhetorical question. Neither translation materially affects the meaning of what Paul says. As he says here in verse 3, rulers are a cause of fear. Now they've translated this as a question. You can translate it easily as a conditional clause. If you want to have no fear of authority, do what is good. And that would not change the meaning of it at all, really. So they translate it as a question, and that's fine. And it communicates The if clause, again, would make it hypothetical anyway. And so this is somewhat hypothetical. Do you want to have no fear of authority? So the first part of the condition or question deals with what the believer wants. Point 22, wishes or desires with respect to his interaction with governmental authorities. 23, the prescription that follows is a simple and straightforward one. If the believer does what is morally right, what has been legislated in the laws of the land, he will not have to concern himself with fear of the government. And 24, it should be noted that Paul is speaking here in very general terms and is addressing matters as they typically occur in the governmental realm. Normally, governmental authorities do not concern themselves with law-abiding citizens. They just don't mess with them. They don't have any reason to. It's the person that wants to break the law or flaunt the law or this or that that they have to deal with. If you go about your business as a law-abiding citizen, what reason would a policeman even have to talk to you? I mean, I get up in the morning, I do my study, okay? I get out, I drive to the grocery store, assuming I can drive there and obey the laws. Shouldn't be that hard. Grocery store for me is only around the corner. I don't have to go very far. And I can get there and get back. How many times would I even have opportunity to interact with a policeman? None. Driving here to Bible class. I mean, unless I was really late. And I had to put the pedal to the metal. Then I might have to interact. But generally speaking, I'm smart. I get up early enough in the morning. I allow myself plenty of time. I'm not rushing out the door screaming as I'm going, what have I forgot, So if you plan ahead, you can alleviate a lot of stress in your life. And you can alleviate a lot of these deals. Why am I speeding? Well, maybe if I'd have gotten around earlier, I wouldn't have to be. But I'm going to be late. Well, you wouldn't be late if you planned a little better. Maybe you should plan better. Maybe that's the real issue. But we can't deal with that here. So again, government authorities don't generally concern themselves with law-abiding citizens. 25, while the first portion of this section focused primarily on the mental attitude orientation that one is to have with respect, Paul again now emphasizes the overt actions of obedience to the existing laws. 26, Paul concludes with another generalization that has been historically true of normal governments. Kings and others in authority have recognized and blessed those that have proven themselves valuable citizens within the kingdom. Daniel is a good example of this. As Daniel distinguished himself, Daniel chapter 2, verse 6. Here's where Nebuchadnezzar has his dream and he tells his wise men, all of his seers and prognosticators and all of that, the Chaldeans. If you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Go ahead now and tell me. But I will honor you. I will reward you for this behavior. And then chapter 46, same chapter. And Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel. Why? Because Daniel interpreted the dream for him. And gave orders to present him an offering and fragrant incense. And verse 48, then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts. And he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon. And the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Why? Because Daniel was a good citizen who aided the kingdom. And he got blessed for that. You can also see chapter 3, 29 and 30, and also chapter 6, verse 3, deals with that as well. So 27, the noun epinos, praise here, deals with the recognition, approval, praise, honor, or commendation that comes to those that are admired for their behavior. And 28, while what has been true in history is still true today, various branches of the local, county, state, and federal government still bestow awards on citizens in recognition of their contributions to civilized society. Whatever they do that's viewed as good and helpful, whether they feed the poor, whether they take meals to the elderly, whatever they do that's viewed as something that's helpful. Act as guardians for young children, foster care people, that kind of thing. Some of these people get on. Teachers get on, and there's always an annual award for teachers that they get. So 29, however, one must avoid reading too much into this statement, At least one interpreter, unlikely others, have stated that all believers, as a certainty, will be recognized by the government for their contributions. And that's taking it a little too far. So, I mean, but see, this is the dogmatism of certain, quote, doctrinal teachers. They just dogmatically get up and make these assertions, and their sheep aren't smart enough to think through it, maybe, and figure out, oh yeah, that's dumb. Not everybody's honored for what they do. But if you do a good job and all of that, and you contribute to society, you may be noticed. That's all we're saying. There's no guarantee that you're going to be noticed. And if you're a normal, humble believer, you don't care to be noticed anyway. I mean, you're not doing it for praise, right? Do you do the right thing so people will look at you and say, oh, you, God, you're wonderful. You are so wonderful. I pat you on the back. I extol you, et cetera, et cetera. So 30, this is clearly incorrect. A typically dogmatic overstatement of the facts that has characterized some doctrinal churches. It is not proven by history, and it is likely foreign to the experience of those within this local body. Hey, how many of you here have a lot of rewards you want to show me? Where the society has recognized you as a great person. If you have some, that's good. You're proving the point of what we're saying here. But if you don't, it doesn't disprove it. It doesn't disprove that certain people do get honor. So, again, it's not true of most believers, typically. So 31, it is clear that Paul here assumes that the laws and functions of the state are consistent with the moral laws and function of God. He does not deal with situations in which secular rulers do not enforce what's morally right, and when they reward wrongdoers. And certainly from history, we have to know that that has happened. Again, all those who do not study history are destined to repeat its mistakes. But certainly, I mean, I don't think you would have to look very far or think very hard to argue that maybe Nazi Germany wasn't a good example of a good government. Yeah. That maybe this wasn't one, while God certainly allowed him to exist, and in fact allowed him to exist to discipline his people. Many Jews met their death at the hands of these people as a part of the judgment for their negative volition. But God didn't establish them and say, okay, look, I want you to be Jew killers. He doesn't give any government that mandate. That's not at all right. So again, most of the time, but you're going to have things where that happens, where governments will cross lines. Okay, that we're not dealing with right this minute. We will address that. But governments can and do certainly cross moral boundaries and all of that. Well, we're not quite going to get this done. Once again, I'm 3 minutes late and a dollar short. So we'll just finish this up here because we've got some verses to look at. So we'll finish this up here on Tuesday and continue on. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the time to come together. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.